Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It can be hard to get humans to care about insects. The monarch butterfly is an exception. We love them. We love to see them. And we worry about them, with good reason. While many of us are planting milkweed in Iowa to support this species, scientists are also working hard to understand why monarchs are so at risk and what we can do to protect them. Karen Oberhauser is one of those scientists. She is the director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum and the founder and director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, a nationwide citizen science project. She'll be giving the Paul L. Arrington Memorial Lecture at Iowa State University this evening at 7 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union, and she is with me now. Hello, Karen.
Hi, it's great to be with you and great to be in Iowa.
Yeah, thank you so much for talking with me. And Karen, you've been studying the monarch butterfly since 1984. What drew you to this species?
Well, initially, I was drawn to studying monarchs because they're relatively easy to study in captivity, easy to raise. They don't have really specific requirements for mating or food, so it's pretty easy to raise them compared to a lot of other butterflies. So I studied basic biology of monarchs. I was particularly interested in reproduction. And then as time went on and monarch numbers became rarer and I started having several graduate students who were also studying monarchs, our research kind of switched to focusing on conservation. So we worked on the habitat of monarchs, what their habitat needs are, what their migratory pathway is, and how that varies from year to year. We studied them in Mexico and looked at conservation in the Mexican overwintering sites. So my research really expanded to focus on the big picture of monarch biology and how we can conserve them.
And when I think about 1984, I have very clear memories from the early 80s of large flocks of monarch butterflies gathering to do that migration. They would gather on a tree or on a stump in my yard, and there would just it would just be orange. It's unbelievable to think about the numbers that we could see back then.
Right. They really have changed. The numbers, we don't really have good numbers from the 1980s because nobody was out there monitoring them carefully. But starting in the early and mid-1990s, several citizen science projects began, and the overwintering sites in Mexico were measured every year. So now we have a very good handle on the population. We have the anecdotal evidence, like what's in your memory and what's in my memory and that of many, many other people. But from the early 1990s, we actually have numbers, and we know that our general sense that monarch numbers are declining by what we go out and see in our backyards is backed up by the numbers.
Before we talk about some of the threats, some of the reasons that those numbers have gotten so low, let's just do a little basic monarch butterfly 101. And I know that you have developed a curriculum to teach students about monarch butterflies in the classroom. So let's do some basics. Tell me a little bit about how this species reproduces and how we interact with it in our environment up here in Iowa.
Yeah, so when we think about monarch biology, I like to think of two cycles. And one is the individual life cycle that each butterfly goes through. They're laid as an egg. The eggs are always laid on milkweed plants. And that is because that's the only food that monarchs can consume. The eggs take 4 to 6 days to hatch under normal summer conditions. If it's really cool, it can take longer, but kind of under normal conditions, the eggs hatch in about 6 days. And then they go through a period of being caterpillars or larvae, and that lasts 10 to 12 days, again, longer if it's cooler. And then the larvae usually crawl off of a milkweed host plant, move on to something else to pupate or to form the chrysalis. So that's the beautiful jade-colored pupa with the gold spots on it that we see sometimes if we're lucky. And they're in that stage for about 1 day less under the same temperature conditions, so say 9 to 12 or 13 days. And then the adults emerge from the pupa or the chrysalis. And then we get into the annual cycle, because what the adults do and how long they live depends on when during the year they're born. So if we think of the monarchs that people are seeing right now, and I know that there are a lot in Iowa, you're seeing them moving south, across the roads, across the fields. So those butterflies are the last generation of the year, and those butterflies are on their way to wintering sites in Mexico. And they've been leaving Iowa and points north and east for the last month and a half or so, and they're flying southward. So the butterflies that you'll probably see in your yard right now are ones that have come from further north. They're probably Minnesotans. They're flying through Iowa on their way south, and they'll arrive starting in late October and through November.
So how many generations of monarch butterflies do we have in a summer? As you said, these are the last generation of the summer. How many have come before?
Yeah, so these are the last ones, and let's kind of get them to Mexico. So these very same butterflies will fly all the way to Mexico. They'll stay all winter in Mexico, and then in mid-March, they'll start back. And then they'll, as soon as they get into northern Mexico and into the southeastern part of the United States from Texas on east, they'll be laying eggs. And so then, so they're laying the first generation of the new year. And then when those eggs go through their whole life cycle, they'll continue the flight northward and get back into Iowa and points east and north. And then they'll go through two or three more generations. So that's a total of three or four generations. And then those middle two generations don't migrate. They don't show directional flight. And then we'll start again next kind of mid-August with the migratory generation.
So that migratory generation that we're seeing leave now, it sounds like they live significantly longer than the other generations?
Right. So that's a really interesting thing about their biology, is that the ones in the summertime are reproductive about 4 or 5 days after they emerge from their chrysalis. So they start using energy to make eggs and to find females to mate with. So they're expending a lot of energy and a lot of resources on reproduction. But the butterflies that we're seeing now moving through Iowa are not reproductive. So they're basically putting off reproduction until next spring, and that means that they have a lot more energy to make this flight and also to stay alive. But they can also, that's the first reason that they can live longer, is that they're not reproducing. But they're also experiencing cool conditions in Mexico. So because they're an insect, their whole metabolism slows down, and they can survive longer under cool conditions.
How do they know to leave and where to go?
Right. That is a great question. So it's two separate questions. So how do they know when it's time to leave? We know that they're taking cues from their environment, because they're not genetically different. It's the same genes in the butterflies that migrate as the ones that don't migrate. So we know that the most important cue that they use is day length, and they're assessing, they can detect the fact that day length is getting shorter. And they probably start to detect that as a caterpillar. So they can sense that days are getting shorter as they're developing. So that's the biggest, most accurate clue that fall is coming, is that days are getting shorter. And the days are getting shorter at a much more rapid rate during the time that the migratory generation is developing. So that's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also using temperature differences between day and night. So even though it can still be really warm in the middle of August during the daytime, we tend to cool down more at nighttime. So it's another kind of cycling thing, that they detect the difference between day and nighttime temperature. And the final thing that kind of helps them make this decision, I'm putting quote marks around that world because it's not something they're really thinking about, but their body is making this decision. They're detecting the quality of their host plants. So at the end of the summer, the host plants are in poor condition. They're starting to get yellow and the leaves are getting old. So that's another clue that we think they use to tell them that it's time to migrate.
All right. So, and so they know to leave.
They know to leave. And now we have to get them there. And that is still an unanswered question. So we know, we have the very kind of gross understanding of, we know how they know which way is south. But if I gave you a compass and you could tell me which way is south, you would not be able to get to an exact spot somewhere south of you. You'd have to have a map in your head. Mm-hmm. So we know that they can tell, basically, they can tell which way is south. They kind of have an internal compass. They know what time it is. And they essentially know that if it's morning, they should keep the sun on their left, and that'll get them south. And if it's afternoon, they should keep the sun on their right, and that'll get them south. But that, what we don't know is how we find those exact spots in Mexico every year. So that's, you know, that'll take some brilliant person that'll figure out how to answer that question someday.
Right, and when we talk about those exact spots in Mexico, I think a lot of us have seen the photos of these incredible flocks of monarchs, because as they're up here in the north, they're spread out all over the place. In Mexico, they gather in very specific places.
Right. They're going to these mountaintops, so they're looking for very specific conditions, which actually are fairly rare, the climatic conditions that they experience in these overwintering sites in Mexico aren't found in a lot of other places. It needs to be cool, but not too cold. They can't stand a lot of storms during the winter time, but it can't be really dry or they desiccate. So there are very specific conditions that are found on these mountaintops kind of in central Mexico. And somehow they find these spots year after year.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Karen Oberhauser. She is director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum and founder and director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, a nationwide citizen science project. She'll be giving the Paul L. Arrington Memorial Lecture at Iowa State University tonight at 7 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the monarch butterfly. We all love to see them, but we're also really concerned about the dwindling numbers of this beautiful insect, and we're concerned with good reason. Karen Oberhauser studies the monarch butterfly. She's the director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum and the founder and director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, which is a nationwide citizen science project. She'll be giving the Paul L. Arrington Memorial Lecture at Iowa State University this evening at 7 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. That is open to the public. And she is with me now. So, Karen, we got through sort of the basics of biology when it comes to monarch butterflies. As I mentioned before, you started studying monarchs back in 1984 when they were pretty abundant. What does the population look like today?
Well, today, this very minute, the population is actually doing pretty well. For this year and last year, numbers were up. So if we kind of imagine that monarch populations, like most insect populations, fluctuate a lot from year to year, we have high years, and sometimes high years are followed by low years, and that kind of year-to-year variation is affected a lot by climatic conditions. So we can superimpose those year-to-year fluctuations on looking at the long-term numbers. If we look at the long-term numbers for the last decade, numbers are about a little less than half of what they were for the previous decade, even taking into account the last 2 years. So this year and last year, monarch numbers are about up to the average of what they were in the previous decade.
Okay, so it's looking good at the moment, but if we look long term, we're still seeing a dramatic decline in the number of monarchs.
Right, a dramatic decline. So this, you know, like I said, we are now up to the average of, and people are saying they're seeing so many butterflies, but they're just not remembering that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, they were seeing this would have been kind of a normal year. There
right.
were years that were much, much higher than this. So, yeah, definitely numbers are down. And I think that it's better to look at these long-term averages. And if we look at 10 years at a time, we've lost more than half of the population.
One of the big changes that has happened in our culture in Iowa, in agriculture in Iowa since the 1980s, was the introduction of Roundup Ready corn and beans. And so the application of Roundup gave farmers the opportunity to kill all those weeds that were so frustrating, but it also killed all the milkweed, which cut down, there used to be so much milkweed everywhere, which cut down on a lot of habitat for monarchs. Do you consider that to be a big factor in the reduction of the population?
Yes, I do. And I think most people would agree that if we look at the numbers and we actually studied how many monarchs came out of cornfields, and actually several Iowa state scientists were involved with this research. We had people in Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota and Maryland and Ontario going out and looking in corn and soybean fields and other kinds of habitat in the year 2000. And there was, like you said, a lot of milkweed growing in these corn and soybean fields, and monarchs were using that milkweed. So we know that before the advent of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans, there was a lot of milkweed in these agricultural fields. And Roundup Ready corn and now corn and soybeans that are resistant to other kinds of herbicides means that resource for monarchs is now gone. So basically, there has been a lot of It's still under the same use from a human perspective. It's still corn and soybeans, a lot of this habitat, but it used to be appropriate for monarchs, and it no longer is.
When we look at the southern United States, and monarchs have to reproduce there as well, as you talked about that migratory population leaving Mexico, coming to the southern United States, there's a reproductive cycle that takes place there. What does habitat look like in that part of the country?
So that's an interesting question, because there is not a lot of corn and there aren't a lot of soybeans grown in the southern part of that, where that first generation comes out of. So we're working on trying to figure out what's going on there. In my opinion, probably a lot of the threat to monarchs in the southern part of the United States has been more climatic. As we know, they've gone through a lot of drought. In the southern, I mean, Texas year after year is having big record-breaking drought years. So that is probably a key driver in the south, as well as the loss of migratory habitat, because all these monarchs that migrate to the south are going through Texas. So the construction of human homes or
right. as
you know,
our urban areas sprawl, that takes away that habitat.
Exactly. So that's, you know, that's not just true in the South. That's true up here.
Right.
We just talked about the habitat loss due to agricultural changes, but there has also been a lot of land that has been taken out of natural areas and put into agricultural production in the last decade plus a few years, probably the last 12 years. There's been a decline in the Conservation Reserve Program land and in other habitats. So we've been losing habitat, not just because of herbicide-tolerant crops. So we know that monarchs need habitat. We know that they're losing habitat. So that kind of gives us our marching orders, that it tells us what in the realm of habitat we need to make up for to get monarch numbers back up to what they used to. But then there are other factors. So this year-to-year variation is driven by climate, we think, and we know that really hot, dry years lead to low monarch numbers. So the reason monarchs are doing well this year is it's the weather has been great for them, and the weather was good for them last year. So we started with a relatively high number, and that relatively high number of monarchs faced good weather conditions. So basically, we know that given good weather conditions, the population can rebound. So now what we need to do is provide enough habitat so that they can hang on during the bad weather years.
What are some of the other threats? If climate change is a major threat, you mentioned increasing drought conditions. We also have increasing extreme weather patterns. What about storms? I mean, some of these extreme storms, does that knock out a lot of monarch butterflies?
Yeah, so the answer to that is it depends. And that's a storm that they will not fly when it's raining or if it's very windy. So stormy conditions can be bad for them, but they're only lethal. They only cause bad problems if they last for a long time. So if we get a series of storms during their migration that really slows their migratory flight down, or a series of storms during their summer breeding period, which prevents them from flying and laying eggs. So they can just hunker down and stand rainy or windy or stormy conditions. The actual storm event isn't going to hurt them. It would just be the longevity of that storm event that would be a problem for them. So definitely climatic factors, storms can have an impact, but they won't necessarily. But other factors are pesticides. So one thing that I'm really concerned about is mosquito control, because when people are spraying for adult mosquitoes, if they're spraying, the yard companies that spray for mosquitoes, those are general insecticides. So any application of insecticides is going to kill monarchs as well as pest insects, but also a lot of other beneficial species. So mosquito spraying, insecticides like neonicotinoids that are applied systemically to plants, so that if you buy a plant from a nursery and it looks really great, it might be that it contains this insecticide in all of its tissues, including its leaves. So neonicotinoids can be a problem. And the fourth, we have habitat, climate, pesticides. And kind of the fourth thing that can affect monarchs, it probably isn't a big driver yet, is invasive species. So there's a kind of a parasitoid fly that was released to control gypsy moths. It doesn't have a common name. Its scientific name is Compsilura concinnata. That species will, in addition to attacking gypsy moths, it attacks a lot of other kinds of butterflies and moths, including monarchs. So that species, was introduced on purpose by humans, and that can have an impact on monarchs. There are a lot of native parasitoid flies, but this one is increasing in frequency in the central part of the United States.
Right, and without natural predators, that could grow a lot.
Yeah, it probably does have some natural predators, but it just the fact that it is being found in monarchs and it hasn't been reported that much in the central part of the United States because it was released in the East and the West Coast. So that's something we worry about, too. So it's kind of the big four things that affect a lot of species: habitat, climate, pesticides, and invasive species.
I'm talking with Karen Oberhauser. She is the director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum and founder and director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project. And Karen, I want to ask you about that project. It's a citizen scientist project. Tell me how citizen scientists can get involved in studying monarchs.
Sure. Well, there are lots of ways, and I'll start with that one, but then can describe a few other ones. So the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project has been going for over 20 years. And in this project, people basically find a patch of milkweed that they want to monitor and go out and look at that milkweed once a week and count how many eggs and caterpillars they see and report that to the website. So we get a good picture of breeding and how monarchs are doing throughout the United States. We have hundreds of volunteers out doing this. People can also take part in a program called Journey North, which is another citizen science program that just this year has moved to the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. And this is a project where people report the first monarch that they see in the springtime, and we can then see the movement of monarchs as they're going north, and they can also report big groups of monarchs that they see migrating south or clustering on trees at nighttime. So that program, Journey North, shows us the northern and southern movement of monarchs in the spring and the fall. There are a couple other programs. One is the Monarch Watch Tagging Program, where people can get little tiny stickers about the size of their little fingernail and stick them on monarch wings, and we use that to track the migration. If we know where a monarch was tagged and somebody finds the monarch later on, we know the route it took during its fall migration. So lots and lots of ways that people can get involved as citizen scientists. And that's one of the reasons we know so much about monarchs, is that people are out there helping us understand their biology.
With the thousands and thousands of acres of corn and soybeans in Iowa, of course, a lot of people have taken it upon themselves to plant milkweed species in their yards to try to create habitat for monarchs. It feels like the balance is maybe out of balance when you think of that, when you think of the impact of gardens versus thousands of acres. But do you feel like it's making an impact that so many people are planting milkweed now?
Definitely. I think that is the way that we're going to solve this problem, is people creating habitat. And that habitat can be in people's yards, urban, suburban, rural yards. It can be along roadsides. It can be in areas that are protected, state, federal, county parks and other areas. So there are lots of potential places that we can be putting monarch habitat, and yards are definitely a good one. And plus, that just gets people more engaged. If they see monarchs in their yards, they learn to appreciate this amazing species. So the planting milkweed, and also thinking of those nectar plants, because the monarchs live about a month as an adult if they're not migratory, and longer if they're migratory, and they need to eat. So it's the nectar sources, flowers, that are provide the food for adults. So milkweed and flowering plants are really important.
A lot of people who do plant milkweed like to take those monarch caterpillars inside and raise them inside and then release the butterfly. I've seen recent articles that say maybe that's not healthy for the butterflies. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's fine in kind of reasonable numbers. So if people are bringing in a few caterpillars from their yard, or even more than a few, and being really careful about how they raise them, I think that they're not doing any harm to those individual caterpillars. I mean, the research that suggested that there might be problems took monarchs and put them in an incubator where they weren't exposed to these, like, decreasing day length. Mm. So if they're sitting on somebody's kitchen table or in a windowsill, they're probably going to be just fine. They're being exposed to outside conditions, and if it's the time for them to migrate, they will probably migrate. So I think that bringing them inside, people aren't saving monarch populations by doing that, but they're not harming them as long as they're feeding them enough and keeping them clean and not raising them in very crowded conditions where diseases could be transmitted between individuals.
We love monarch butterflies, but there are lots and lots of insects that we don't see, don't acknowledge, don't like, don't care about. What does the plight of the monarch tell us about these other insects that, of course, are also essential parts of our ecosystem?
Right. I think that's a really great question and a really important thing to think about. And why I see monarchs, I'm a conservation biologist, so it's not just monarchs that I'm concerned about, but the reason that I think monarchs are a great species to focus on is because people do care about them. And when we create habitat for monarchs, we're helping a lot of other species that people just don't notice. So all those insect species out there really monarchs are the flagship for those. So what we do for monarchs is going to benefit these other species, and also what we're learning about monarchs and what we're learning about what's happening to their numbers is reflective of what's going on with other species as well. So monarchs both help us understand what's going on in the natural world, but I think even more importantly, they make us want to help it. So anything people do for monarchs is great. It's not just for the monarchs, it's for a lot of other things at the same time.
Karen Oberhauser, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk with you today, Charity.
Karen Oberhauser is director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum, the founder and director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, and she'll be speaking in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at Iowa State University this evening at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.